the CYC podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 81. I'm Wolfgang Bashaw. This month is not actually a discussion on child and youth care, but rather a presentation on child and youth care. In May 2016, there was a report released called Because Young People Matter, Report of the Residential Services Review Panel. It looks at the state of residential care in Ontario. You can find a link to it at www.cycpodcast.org. Shortly before it was released, one of the report's authors, Kiris Garibagi, gave the closing note speech at the Canadian National CYC Conference in Halifax. With his permission, we are posting his full one-hour presentation. In the talk, he discusses what he learned from the report and makes many recommendations. His presentation takes everyone who works in child and youth care to task. He also offers concrete ways to make the changes needed. Much of what Garibagi has to say is provocative, and all of it is worth listening to. I hope you enjoy it.
It gives me a great honor to introduce Kiris Garibagi. I had a lengthy introduction, and he said, just say, here's Kiris.
All right, welcome to Friday morning. The morning after the banquet. Soaked kidneys, I can see them from here. That's a good thing. It seems like just 2 days ago that this adventure started. And I just want to say that, how many people were here at the opening? I'm just curious. Were you all here? Yeah? That was excellent. And as much as I value continuity, I'm not going to talk shit today. So I just want you to know that ahead of time. In fact, I've been told that several times, actually most of my life really, that I'm not a super uplifting speaker. I'm a little depressing sometimes. So I've also been told that in order to mitigate that a little bit, I should say some good things, some positive things, you know, it'll create a little bit of balance. So I just want to start there so we're in good spirits and I can afford to say some less positive things as we move forward. First of all, Jack Phelan is here. He won an award yesterday. Isn't he awesome? Tina Kroll brought 9 students, I think, from Newfoundland. Which is, isn't that awesome? We have Jennifer Martin here, who is only one of 2 directors of graduate programs in child and youth care in the entire country. Isn't that awesome? And also here is Grant Charles. I got nothing. Sorry, man. I got nothing. Yeah. Okay, is that enough love? Can we move on? I feel I've done what I have to. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit today about, I just want to put together my 30 years of thinking about child and youth care and thinking about child and youth services and how those two things connect. Because, you know, I do understand that talking about child and youth care is not the same as talking about child and youth services. Many child and youth services have no child and youth care workers in sight. But nevertheless, these two things clearly connect, and so I want to talk about that a little bit. And everything I'm going to say is informed by a whole bunch of different stuff. It's informed by my own experiences in the fields of practice, and I've worked in Nova Scotia, by the way, for several years, but also in Ontario and in Quebec. In just about every setting you can imagine. I teach, I read, I write. I often do training, and I find training is a great place to find out what's really happening in the field, because people eventually get a little looser and start talking about their experiences and their challenges and the adversities and the things they observe, the things they see. I've had many placement students. That's a great source of information, by the way, in terms of what's good out there and what's not so good out there. And then most recently, I spent quite a few months very intensively with a number of colleagues looking at residential services in Ontario. And of course, you can look at residential services unless you also look at non-residential services, because those two things are often very connected. And so that was a really interesting experience for me, not because I learned a whole bunch of new stuff. I did learn some new things, but perhaps more so because it really was a way of seeing it all in a fairly short time, in a fairly intensive time, just sort of laid out in front of me. You know, where we've gotten after so many years, so many decades of trying to do something useful for young people who might be facing all kinds of different adversities. And so all of these things inform me. Everything I'm going to say is not strictly based on this residential services review, but certainly is a that certainly served as a catalyst for me to bring that forward a little bit. And I want to sort of put this in the context of introducing you to someone. Let's see if this works. There we go. So I want to introduce you to Haley as a way of creating some context for all the stuff I'm about to say, because I think it's a really important piece. So this residential services review involved a panel of really 7 people, but officially a panel of 3 people and a number of research assistants. And one of those research assistants was Haley. Haley is here, by the way. And I have permission to use her name. And what you need to know about Haley is that she's 23, which makes her an adult and a youth at the same time. She is an absolutely brilliant student, one of our top students in our school. If you've never seen an A+, ask her what it looks like. It's apparently it's very attractive. She has great insight into things, but she's not jaded because she hasn't worked in the field for 30 years. So really a very good way of seeing things, informed by being relatively young, informed by being well-read, informed by understanding content, substance, critical insight into all matters child and youth care and child and youth services. A smart person. And so I always think it ought to matter what a smart person who is relevant to the people we work with in terms of age, who's well-read in our field, who understands a lot of context, might think about the stuff that young people experience. I think that's very relevant. And I will tell you that in this process of the residential services review, we had been working intensely for about 4 or 5 months, which means that Haley would have reviewed thousands of pages of reports done on child and youth services in Ontario. She would have met with a lot of young people. She would have met with executive directors, senior managers, frontline staff, foster parents. She would have heard what they have to say. She really would have exposed herself very intensely and significantly to the kinds of things that child and youth care practitioners are exposed to. And after about 4 or 5 months of this doing this, she walked into my office one day, and she looked at me, and she asked me a question. And I really wasn't prepared for the question at that particular moment in time. The question was this. Do young people matter? And I thought, wow, what a question for somebody to ask after having gone through all of this process, after having talked to so many people and read everything that government, service providers, practitioners, foster parents has talked about. It's not clear to this person, who ought to have a fairly decent way of understanding the context, whether young people actually matter in all of this. So much noise, so much conversation. This question is not clear. That's really horrifying. I thought, wow, that's really horrifying. It's one thing for my grandmother to ask that question, but it's quite another for Haley to ask that question. And I think we should be deeply concerned when that happens, because here we have Haley, but I know there are many other students here. There are thousands of students across the country. And I bet you she's not the only one who, after being exposed to our context, is asking that question. So that's the context in which I'm trying to think about everything that I have experienced, everything that I have come to, I think, know about child and youth services and child and youth care. So some of the stuff I've learned about the different players, so to speak, who are involved in our broader life, in our professional life. Government, of course, is one of those players, and government, particularly civil service, not so much the politicians, but civil service, you know, because they have a significant impact on what happens to us, on our context, on how we can work, and so on. And I can honestly say in all my years of working with people in government, I like them. I like them individually. I think people work incredibly hard. I think, in fact, I mean, it's ridiculous how hardworking the working environment of government departments really seem. The phone's always ringing. There's all kinds of activity, meetings, endless meetings, and so on. So I cannot blame any government official I've ever met for not working hard enough. But I've learned over time that notwithstanding pronouncements to the contrary, the fundamental logic of operation in government is just don't go changing. Because change means you have to contain the fallout. Those ripple effects we heard about on the first day ideally aren't too big. Change must be so gradual that it almost certainly will be longer than the lifetime of the young person while they are receiving our services or while they're engaged with us. And so government is just not a good place to look to find ways of really significantly changing the experience that young people have. And it's probably not a great place to look for some sort of impetus or some sort of initiative around changing our experience and our context of working with young people or being with young people. I am not disillusioned by the people in government, but I have grown somewhat cynical of the process of government, because I'm increasingly understanding that notwithstanding talk about transformations and change and making things better, that really the fundamental goal is to contain the fallout of whatever may happen. And it doesn't really appear to matter what sort of government or what ideological orientation there is. If you have medication, you can pull it out. I'm very open to that, by the way, for anything you might need. Service leaders. So this is probably the group that I've had the most contact with in recent years. People who run agencies, executive directors, senior managers, those kinds of people. And you know, it's my experience around that has been that, first of all, I like most of them. There are so many of you here, so I have to say that right now. But you know, I really do like you. And you're probably, if you're here, you're probably not entirely representative of service leaders across the system, because you had a child and youth care conference. And I applaud you for that, by the way. But service leaders are very interesting people, because every time I talk with them and I ask them, you know, tell me what you do, describe your services, you know, what are you thinking, where is it coming from, where do you want to go with these, it always sounds fantastic. I have rarely met a leader in the services for children and youth who tells me, you know, we kind of suck, but it's a job. That doesn't happen. They have great stories to tell. The language is phenomenal. Everything fits in place. It's current. Everything is evidence-based. Everything is this. Everything is that. And I remember one time in particular, this was my first clue that maybe this is not entirely accurate. One time in particular, I was sitting with a management group, including the executive director of a fairly large agency in Ontario, and I was being told what they do, and it really was phenomenal. And so, as I always do, I said, listen, this is great. I'm really excited. I must see this so that I can promote your agency as a good model for other people. But to do that, I have to actually see with my own eyes. So do you mind if I take a little bit of a tour and see what's going on here? And I said, yeah, no, sure, absolutely, go on a tour. First place I walked into, I'm not kidding you, the very first place I walked into, I walk in, and all I see is a huge guy standing in front of an open door bedroom, and I hear a kid in the bedroom screaming, yelling, going on, and I hear the guy saying, if you touch that thing, you're never getting out of here. It was the first interaction. And I later found out that the thing was a stuffed animal that apparently the kid had been throwing at people, and so he was not to touch the stuffed animal. And I tried to put that together with everything the managers had told me, and I thought, no, that's not what's happening here. This is the story you tell, but it's not what's happening here. And it wasn't a coincidence. This wasn't a, just a, statistically, it's very unlikely for this to have been a coincidence that I just happened to walk in the one moment when something goes wrong. No, this is a regular practice. It is a regular practice. And so it doesn't mean everybody does that. I'm sure everybody who's here would never do such a thing. Because you're here, again, you're not very representative, by the way, of the child and youth care community for that reason. But this is a regular practice. It happens all the time. And the greatness of the lingo we use to build around these practices really doesn't do anything to change those practices. And I just keep seeing it. I wish I wouldn't. I wish I could walk in and say, oh, I finally see the change. But I don't see the change. So maybe I'm blind, but I don't think I am. Practitioners. This is the hard part because, you know, it's a child and youth care conference. But, you know, I love child and youth care practitioners. I consider myself to be a child and youth care practitioner. So please take this with love and admiration. But, you know, increasingly it's clear to me that a lot of practitioners are really trying very hard to be hip with the times, to adopt the lingo, the rhetoric, the concepts, the ideas that you hear about in the broader field. And I know that many post-secondary institutions are busy changing curriculum to also adapt to new lingo, to evidence-based practice kinds of things. And it's sounding really awkward to me. I just got to be honest, it's sounding very, very awkward to me. Lots of practitioners now identify themselves, you know, I'm a clinical practitioner. And then when I say, have you ever looked up the word clinical in a dictionary? You know what it means? It means cold, detached, disconnected, surgical. Really? You're a clinical practitioner? Good luck with that. So there is this awkwardness around how even practitioners are beginning to talk about what it is they do, why they do it, the context in which they do it. I find that really worrisome, and I wonder just to what extent we are promoting this in many ways, so perpetuating this particular issue. I also find practitioners are very busy lamenting what there isn't. The resources that are missing, the, you know, the shifts that are too long, all the things that just aren't there to support them in their everyday work. Now, I know that's actually true, so I'm with you. But it takes a lot of time and energy to lament. Just as a practice, lamenting is time-consuming, draining, and may or may not leave a lot for the other thing that practitioners clearly are busy with, which is the everyday, which is good. That's what we want to be busy with in so many different ways. But this is my experience of practitioners today. And, you know, over drinks, we've been joking in the last few days about what practice used to look like. And aside from being highly illegal in so many different ways, clearly we were less awkward. Well, not so much me, but, you know, people like Tom might have been a little less awkward than me. Of course, there are researchers. Sadly, I have to take that mantle as well because my job requires it. And, you know, I'm becoming very, sorry guys, all my friends here who call themselves researchers, I'm becoming very annoyed with researchers, I have to say. Because there is just so much talk about, well, we just don't know enough, we need more data, we need different data, we need better data, we need different methods, we need this, we need that, we need the other. And you can clearly see that this is a self-perpetuating industry that is good and useful, don't let me knock research, but that in and of itself is probably not having quite the impact that that one might hope if the starting point is young people. Of course, if the starting point is something else, it might have a significant impact, I'm not sure. And then we have the media in Ontario. The media is going crazy right now, which is always fun to see. But the media contribution to the lives of young people is that N equals one. So every story, it's a horrible story. You can read every day in the Toronto Star, you can read an absolutely horrible story about the experience of one person that then is generalized to the catastrophe represented by the various child and youth serving systems. And of course, that's probably also not a particularly useful way of representing or of articulating how child and youth services are working, how they're not working, and so on. So all these different kinds of stakeholders contributing something, but contributing it in ways that aren't quite really cutting it, in my opinion, at least. There are also young people, of course, who have opinions about what they experience. And young people are, at the very least, we can say about young people that what they might have to say about their experience ought to matter. There are lots of young people who are doing really well. And I know in some of your services, because I've been to some of your services and I've met some of the young people, there are a lot of good things happening. There are young people who are really thriving, or at the very least are not experiencing any sort of disasters as they're going through a journey of living life away from home. Often very connected to home or to family or to kin or to those they consider kin. But there are also, almost every young person has a story to tell that isn't a very positive story. And while there are thousands of different things they talk about, anything from a lack of privacy to relationships that don't seem quite authentic, to being moved around too often, and all of those kinds of things, fundamentally, my experience has been, they talk about the things that are up there on the slide, that there is no love in their life, which is a real issue. And I don't know if anybody here, I assume by now everybody here reads CYCNet, but I wrote a little column about that earlier this year. I think it was called Love and Sex in Child and Youth Care or something. I figured the word sex would sell the column, but not sure how well that worked out. But you know, just on the topic of love, my experience recently was we were writing the report for the Residential Services Review, and we peppered the report full with the word of love and intimacy. It was all about love and intimacy. And the review on the report, so when the government got back to us, was, you know, it's all good, but do you have to use the word love? And the rationale for not using the word love, and I can understand that one can have a conversation on the merits of using the word love. I think we should use it. But I understand the conversation, at least. But the rationale in this case was that if we start talking about loving kids, then the workers in the various facilities will think it's a permission to have sex with them. I'm not kidding you. This was the rationale for why we should not use the word love in talking about how we are with kids. And I thought, wow, you know, that's very telling about how we're, not just we, how our context is viewed, how unbelievably primitive this whole context is being articulated as. It's really quite sad in so many different ways. Humorous on a bad day, on a cynical day, you know, when the weather is bad and you need to be a little cynical, but not good. Young people talk about no safety in their lives, and depending on where you're positioned, particularly from my identity perspective, that's a really significant problem. Gender identity in particular often is a major root or a major cause of a lack of safety. So we know that young people really don't feel particularly safe, notwithstanding our emphasis on safety. They talk about no vision. I know we have plans of care, but for a young person, a plan of care does not provide a sense of vision for their lives. And they talk about just not feeling inspired. There's just no spark. And I have to say, when I see young people talk about their experiences, no matter how they talk about it, whether they're positive experiences or negative experiences, the one thing I always notice is there may be anger, there may be excitement, there may be some sort of emotional representation of how they're feeling, but there is rarely a spark in their eyes. You know, that the glistening eye, the twinkle in the eye that we sometimes talk about in the context of child and youth care practitioners, not so much, really not there. So that's not a happy thought. Double dosing is okay, just so you know. So I'm really fascinated by our beautiful rhetorical trends in our field that we're all engaged with in some way or another. The literature is engaged with them. You know, rhetoric is a powerful thing. It is really not an exaggeration to say that the first measure of value is not substance but rhetoric, the quality of rhetoric that one can produce. There's no question about that. That's true for students writing papers. You know, a well-written paper, even if substantively a little mediocre, will get a better grade than a really badly written paper. Students, listen up. That may be substantively great. So rhetoric really matters, language really matters. Here's some rhetoric that I find particularly in need of engagement, let's say. So multidisciplinary treatment is an interesting term, I always think. I love that term. You know, one of the things that I've been doing in recent months is I ask everybody, you know, when you say you provide treatment to young people, what does that mean? And I'm amazed at the blank stares I get from agencies that are called treatment agencies. You know, even in the Children's Mental Health Center, there's accredited service providers that provide treatment. I say, you know, what does treatment actually mean? Blank stares. Or some reference to the treatment value of structure, routine, that kind of thing. Sometimes on a good day, some reference to family, although we can talk about what that might mean. But it is clearly there is a perception that if you have a multidisciplinary treatment team, you are therefore providing very positive or very useful treatment to young people. And I always think to myself, while I recognize that it is useful to have many different perspectives coming together along with a young person to talk about what might be next and so on, that just having a multidisciplinary treatment team in and of itself is neither good nor bad. If you hire an idiot psychologist, a really bad social worker, and a profoundly lazy child and youth care practitioner, then from the perspective of the young person, the multidisciplinarity of that team is like a nightmare. Now you don't just have one really useless person in your life, you got three of them. So, you know, it's really so profoundly ridiculous that we have terms like multidisciplinary treatment and think that having those terms in and of itself is a valuable contribution to something, or to young people. Evidence-based practices is sort of the favorite term that everybody either likes to knock or celebrate. But I will tell you this, as part of the review, we sat in one agency, accredited Children's Mental Health Center, a really big one, and we were given the rundown on the evidence-based practices the agency has by the management group. 10 minutes later, we're sitting with the staff group. First question. So, how are the evidence-based practices working for you? What evidence-based practices was the answer? So, you know, no matter what we think about evidence-based practices, Carol Stewart, I think, provided us with some good insight and different ways of thinking about that. But no matter what we think about them, I question whether they even exist at this point in practice. I'm just not convinced that it's actually there. Family-based care is an interesting concept. It's the word in not just in Ontario. I think it's the word in international child and youth care practice in so many different ways. And I can't tell you how many places I've been driving up to in recent months, actually over a couple of years at least, to visit a family-based care environment, only to find 7 cars parked in front of the house. I walk in, they're like 14 staff, they're all one-on-one workers, or two-on-one workers, or three-on-one workers, and eventually I find the live-in person who apparently is the criteria for making it family-based care. And this is probably the fastest growing sector in residential services, at least in Ontario it is, and I suspect it is in many other places as well. So I'm not really convinced that the substance that we're looking for in the context of family-based care is entirely there. System integration and community collaboration are notable particularly for their multi-syllable sort of way in which they're articulated. It just sounds great. And, you know, I have to say that the only time I find these things actually working is if they're carried out or if they're initiated by very, very small organizations that don't have any baggage around them. But most of the time, these kinds of things are initiated either by government, and then people just follow what it is they think they're supposed to do, or by large institutional actors. And then we have this awkward thing of institutionally initiated community collaboration. And you can imagine that the oxymoronic nature of that concept creates some problems. There are exceptions. Let me be clear. There are lots of exceptions. Ottawa is a city that has worked really, really hard to create a community collaboration around collaborative problem solving. So they have, and they've done quite well at that. There are a number of agencies that are participating. They're doing some good work. There are lots of exceptions to these things. I'm not suggesting that everybody who is involved in child and youth services is suffering from the deficits associated with some of the thoughtlessness, robustness of these terms. But system-wide, or if you look at the whole thing, if you reflect over time and over space, we got some serious issues that have to be engaged in some way. And of course, we have beautiful language. For example, hard to serve kids. It was a very popular term in the 80s, but it's still used today. Now it's, you know, that we have some fancier terms, but that term is still used. Complex special needs, young people with complex special needs. That's a whole funding stream in Ontario that comes with that. It's a really fascinating term. I always wonder who came up with that. I pictured two people. One said, I want to call it complex kids, and the other one said, I want to call it special kids, and then in typical Canadian fashion, okay, let's do both. I think that's how that happened. The plan of care, you know, this is the foundation of service for children and youth in Canada. We plan everything. But the idea that we are planning care, which means that, you know, since a plan hasn't been implemented yet, that there is a moment when we're not caring, just by definition, is ludicrous. That's ludicrous. The foundation of everything we do, the plan of care, is at least systemically the foundation, and even legislatively the foundation, is itself kind of a weird concept if you think about that. My kids certainly do not have a plan of care. I just want to be clear on that. They also don't have a plan, but they are cared for, I think. Case management, anybody want to be a case? And would you like to be managed? Some beautiful language we have to describe how we're going to be with young people. And it is the dominant language, and I want to point out this is not just the language of other professions. This is our language, too. We use this language all the time. It's in our textbooks. It's in the writings we see. This is child and youth care cannot claim to have stepped beyond this language. This is part of our everyday. We're participating. Maybe we didn't initiate these words, but we're definitely participating in them. So we're guilty. If you have any worries about this kind of language, congratulations. They're legitimate worries, and we're guilty. So that, by the way, was not the cynical view. Now it comes. Just in case you were worried that I thought it was going to be a dark and... Okay, the accomplishment. So this is, I call it a cynical view just as a qualifier, but in fact, I think, I don't think it's really that cynical. I think it's just real, and it's good sometimes to, you know, engage people and say, hey, let's talk about it. You know, this is a safe place, I think. So let's just talk about it. So here's the first accomplishment that I think we have really, we can sit back and say, yep, we've done it. We have really solidified the construction of young people as objects in our context. You know, nobody wants to hear it. The reality is, in the everyday, in the way our system moves, in the way services are provided, young people clearly and categorically are objects, not subjects. Which is, it fits with the paradigmatic dominance of the concept of treatment. It fits with the concept of, for example, placement changes. Placement change from the perspective of a young person is that you are given from one person to another. Placement change is just a very polite word. It fits even sort of on a symbolic level with the way we move young people, often carrying garbage bags with their belongings from one placement to the other. It fits with the notion that young people have to fit a program, just like an object has to look good in a program. And if they don't, just like an object, you just get rid of it. Everything we do really, constructs young, solidifies this understanding of young people as objects. And just because we value relationships and just because we value connections, unless we do that in very specific and very particular ways, we're not really mitigating that. It's not to say that there aren't instances, that there are moments, maybe a lot of moments, when that's not the case, when young people are with child and youth care practitioners, when there is a journey that is unfolding in tandem together. But overall, when we think about what are young people, then the answer, all the visible answers that we have, construct young people as objects. Now, we shouldn't cry about that. It's okay. We live in a very sort of positivist, very material, very consumerist society. We're familiar with objects. We're very good with objects in many ways. But we should be aware that this is what we're doing. This is really what we're doing. So that's a pretty significant thing. There is one accomplishment. I won't ask you to applaud it. Here's another accomplishment. We have become unbelievably good at accepting things that to anybody outside of these fields would be considered absolutely absurd. And I mean literally absurd. Here's a list of examples. I'll just mention them briefly. And they cover everything from the everyday to the broad systemic issues. Treatment foster care, very popular concept these days. In Ontario, we call everything treatment foster care. You know, I asked somebody, what makes you treatment foster care as opposed to foster care? And this was the answer, I kid you not. The answer was, I did a psychology BA in the 60s at Trent. That's it. That was the answer. Yeah. That is what made this particular foster home a treatment foster home, and some other foster home, a regular foster home, or a special foster home, or a super-duper treatment foster home, or whatever other sort of label we have. That's absurd. Shampoo by ration. So there's a place, a residential service provider in Ontario, that does, you know, reasonable work, nice people. They have a rule that came out of years ago, some kids throwing their shampoo around the shower and wasting it. That was years ago. Some kids who are by now, you know, adults somewhere, or not, depending on what happened. And the rule is that on the first of every month, you're given a ration of shampoo. And if you run out of that shampoo in the middle of the month, then you have to use your allowance to buy more shampoo so you can make it to the end of the month. And I even asked, it seemed like an obvious question, and I tend to be sensitive to these kinds of questions. I said, listen, does it make a difference whether you have hair like me? Or, you know, whether you have hair like, pick someone with a little more hair than me. And the answer was no. That doesn't make a difference. I get the same ration as some of you would who don't quite look like me. I think that's amazing. I think that's absurd. And I want to remind you that the people who implement this rule are child and youth care practitioners. Trained child and youth care practitioners in Ontario, almost everybody working in children's mental health residential treatment has a child and youth care diploma. So this is not some absurd thing happening or being done by other people. It's us. We're doing it. It doesn't seem to occur to us that strange rule. You know, really, you know, it doesn't seem normal. We have, what else we got? Oh, well, this is fun in a Canadian context. Post-2015, there's a place, high-end. This is one of the most expensive places in the country on a per diem basis, where there is a rule that Aboriginal youth cannot speak to each other, it's a secure context, cannot speak to each other in their own language, lest they be forming a conspiracy to escape or to do something bad or to challenge the system or whatever. In Canada, in 2016, we have publicly funded institutions in which only child and youth care practitioners work every day, enforcing the denial of language rights of Aboriginal youth. Every day, right now. That happens. Like, I'm not making it up. This is real. And it's absurd. It is surely absurd. Assessments for Another Planet. I'll tell you about another agency. I won't tell you where it is. This is actually a very good place, I think. They do great work. They're very nice to kids, so I like them. And they cost many millions of dollars because they're big and they're expensive. Not to kids, of course. It's free to kids and families. And they bring young people in for 3 months. Child and youth care practitioners provide treatment and do clinical practice and evidence-based whatever. And by all reports, including the reports of the young people and their families, it's great. The 3 months are awesome. And then the outcome, this is the design of the place. The outcome is that the place provides a list of recommendations to the family about what to do long term. And the feedback has been for the entire time that this place has existed, that while these recommendations sound great, they cannot be implemented because they're not connected to anything that actually exists. But that's been going on for like 10 years. Who does that? You know, what is the point of having a 3 months placement that you know ahead of time will produce an outcome that cannot be implemented, that is useless to the people you're giving it to, because it just can't be implemented. Millions of dollars. Just, you know, give every child and youth care practitioner a raise, it would be a much better investment. I already mentioned plans of care. Supervision is one of the things that disturbs me in the residential care sector in particular, because everybody I asked on this particular review that I just undertook, or that we just undertook, when I asked, what's your supervision model? Blank stares, no answer. And in some cases, I hired my niece, I hired my nephew, they had to make a little more money, so they're the supervisor. This stuff happens. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of kids who live in places taken care of by child and youth care practitioners who receive zero supervision, or who receive supervision that is about when they can take vacation, or, you know, they screwed something up, here's your letter of reprimand, or that kind of stuff, which is clearly not supervision. It's called performance management, totally inappropriate in a child and youth care context. But that's a little worrisome, isn't it? Isn't that worrisome? So absurdities, and we accept them. I say we accept them. You might feel, oh, well, it's outrageous. But why do you feel that way? Because you know it's happening. It might be happening in your places. You may have worked somewhere, maybe you don't work there anymore, but that's happening. We know this is real. This stuff happens. I'm sure you have similar stories. I'm sure many of you could tell me stories that would blow my mind. But we accept it. It's absurd. Ah, it'll be absurd tomorrow, too. So, the overall trend is a movement to a place of last resort, I think. A place of last resort means that we try things with young people. The mantra is least intrusive to most intrusive, right? So everybody's talking about that these days. So we try stuff. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, let's go one step more intrusive. Until we get to a place where nothing has worked, years of young people experiencing failure, years of young people experiencing the offer of relationship that turned out to be unreal or not authentic or not sustainable. And then we get to the place where the only thing left is let's make sure this young person is in a setting where child and youth care practitioners can do their thing. And while we think our thing is awesome, and it is, let me be clear, if we do child and youth care really well, it is an awesome thing. The system thinks that's not why the system is putting kids there. The system is putting kids there because nothing else worked, not because there's the slightest clue about what child and youth care practice actually is. So the movement to last resort really is, we failed, now we need something that we don't really want, that's why it's called the last resort. So, you know, we're okay with placing kids where we don't want to place them, that's just by definition true. And usually that means in the context of education, special classrooms, and in the context of placement or living situation, group care. That's usually what that means. Or nowadays, very intensive family-based care with 7 cars in the driveway. Oops. And the expectation, I want to be really clear, from the perspective of the people pulling the strings, are not relational practice. The expectations are not kindness. The expectations are not being with young people, sitting, hanging out, having lunch, farting in the van, as Mark used to say. No, those are not the expectations. These are the expectations. Containment, safety, control, surveillance. These are the expectations. If that happens, placement is good. It's all good. We don't have a problem. Jack and I did some research on that, actually, both in Alberta and Ontario, and found that notwithstanding all the rhetoric, this is in fact what the child and youth care practitioners in those places see as their job. Again, I don't see any of those child and youth care practitioners I spoke to here, so it's not representative of you. So you can feel okay about that. Interestingly, it's achieving those things by any means necessary, and we know this to be true. It really is by any means necessary. Often, of course, it doesn't always have to be these things, but it can be segregation, and of course, special classrooms, group homes in very rural areas, all of these really are forms of segregation. It can be by physical and or chemical restraint, and it certainly can be, and it almost always is, by rules, routines, structure, procedures that I at least would consider draconian, but I'm a little anti-structure, so I may not be entirely representative of that either. At this point, by the way, we've moved from people of various disciplinary backgrounds to the world of child and youth care. I hope you followed me in that journey. This is the world of child and youth care. This is what we do. In most cases, we meaning child and youth care practitioners with formal, accredited, or soon to be accredited training in child and youth care practice. So, I'm going to move it the other, I'm going to make a slight turn now. We don't want to be a professional last resort. I just really don't think that that ought to be the goal. But we have to do something to not be a professional of last resort, because I very much believe, and I've heard enough from people who matter in this context, that we are in fact seen as a profession of last resort. The people who work directly with young people who are seen to have failed, of course it's not the young people who have failed, but who are seen to have failed, are seen as the last resort. That means we are seen as the last resort. And you know last resorts, nobody invests in a last resort. What's the point? You know, we're hoping we'll never have to use it, even though the evidence clearly shows we're using it every day. But we're hoping we'll never have to use it, so why invest there? It's a dying animal anyways. We don't want to be there. That's not what we want to be. But to avoid that, I think, we got to change a few things. I'm just going to be silent. So, I like you all, and you used to like me. I know that. But, you know, the whining's got to stop. Like, it really does. And don't get me wrong. I want to, first of all, acknowledge sincerely and fully recognize that almost everybody who works directly with young people is undervalued, particularly in a monetary way. Let me be clear. You should all get paid at least double of what you're getting paid, maybe more. Or maybe it's just priceless, but that would sound too corporate, to quote MasterCard. Of course that's true. Of course you should be much more central in the context of what you do with young people and how that fits in narratives about how we are with young people and so on. I want to acknowledge all of that. So there is reason to complain. There is reason that's perfect, really good reason to whine. It's just that it doesn't help because we've been doing that for a long time. And it misrepresents, in fact, I think the very heart and spirit of child and youth care practice, the way that I at least think of it as that ideal that we strive for. And to me, those things are about courage and strength and doing stuff that's crazy, but doing it anyways and figuring it out. And relational commitment that really is not even realistic given the logistical context of doing child and youth care, but we do it anyways. Like just all the stuff that one wouldn't normally associate with whining is what we're actually good at, is what we should be doing, is what we should be talking about. Not whining, because nobody likes a whiner. That's just how it is. So I think we got to stop the whining, and we got to refocus a little bit, even if our circumstances are not great. And I recognize and I appreciate that often they're not great. People have families, mortgages to pay, car loans to make, and so on. I recognize all of those things. Whining isn't going to help you. The other thing, though, the flip side of that, is we also got to get past the mythology that if you are really a committed child and youth care practitioner, you're going to be broke for the rest of your life. This is not true. I just want to let you know, this is not true. Might be true for me, but I spend a lot of money on alcohol. But it is simply not true. I know in this room, I won't point to anybody in particular, there are a lot of people whose lives are shaped, whose economic lives are shaped by the field of child and youth care practice, who have six-figure incomes, and I think, although I've never seen their tax returns, possibly seven-figure incomes. Child and youth care is not a broke profession. You do not have to be poor if you get into child and youth care practice. This is a myth, today at least. It is a myth. There is opportunity. There are possibilities. There's all kinds of stuff you can do to have quite a comfortable life, if I may say so myself. So let's get past some of that stuff, because it holds us back. Okay. Here's another thing we got to do. It speaks to the absurdities we so readily accept. We have to reject mediocrity. You know, on a good day, when I'm feeling really uplifted and positive, and I just want to, you know, exude sunshine, I would say to you, yeah, there's a lot of mediocre stuff going on. That'd be me being positive. And the reality is, it really is, in a good scenario, just mediocre. As if the young people we work with have a much lower standard of what the life ought to be than young people who perhaps don't need us to get involved with them. Mediocrity has to end. The goal is excellence, fantasticness, awesomeness, just everything is incredible. If that's not the goal, we ought to go home. Because in the context of mediocrity, one begins to accept absurdities that everybody else who's not involved can recognize and we see as normal. So I think we should go to work every day, whether we run an agency, whether we work directly with young people, whether we teach in a university or a college, no matter what our role, no matter what our frame of reference to the field, with the idea that if it's mediocre, it's not good enough. We're not mediocre kind of people. You're awesome. Right? Of course, that requires some courage, because the first few times you try not to be mediocre, somebody will tell you, hey, 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 get back to being mediocre. They'll say it in a different way, but it does happen, and we all know that. And so it does require some courage, and it probably requires some collective action. It probably requires a bit of a culture shift in our field to not see ourselves as being the little people trying to do big things, but really seeing ourselves as, you know, we got something that isn't just for us, but everybody should take a little bit of what we got. That kind of courage, I think, is what we need. So my apologies to Jim Anglin, who wrote an article many years ago that was called Child and Youth Care, a Unique Profession. I think we should stop saying that. At the time, that made sense to me. Today, not so much. I think we should stop aiming to be unique. You know that phrase, Child and Youth Care, we're very unique people, we're a unique profession. Why do you want to be unique? Being unique means you're not part of the action. You're different. I don't think we should be unique. I think everybody else should become like us. You know, the great quote, I love this, child and youth care is a way of being in this world. Shouldn't that apply to everybody who's involved with young people? Like, really? So we don't want that to be a unique thing. We want everybody to think that. We really want everybody to be in the world in a particular way, because, by the way, young people don't always pick the child and youth care practitioner as that important person, right? Sometimes they'll pick the social worker, and we don't understand that, but they do. Sometimes they pick, you know, the cook or the person driving them to school or whoever they might pick, their soccer coach. Right? So let's stop trying to be unique and let's start trying to make everybody else a little bit more like us. That'll be good. Sorry? Okay, there we go. Yeah, you're a good friend, I have to say. Yes. Okay. On a slightly more complicated level, I think we have to avoid dialectical movements that are very present in our field. Dialectical in this context, I'm using the word to say there are movements about the same thing that are happening in two different directions, in fact, in opposite directions. Examples of that, relational, trying to talk about and being relational in our approach, while at the same time imposing control, using rules, structure, routines, those kinds of things to impose control. That doesn't actually work, and from the perspective of a young person, it's just plain crazy. Who would do that? You can't do both of those things at the same time. In my view, if you're a child and youth care practitioner and you're working in a place where somebody is using token economies or point and level systems, you should just say to yourself, okay, you know, this is just not a relational place. Either we get rid of the point and level system or we don't do child and youth care. It's okay either way, but, you know, take your pick. You can't do both at the same time. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to me. That certainly means it won't make sense to young people. Here's a tough one. I challenge my colleagues in the post-secondary education system. You know, I just want to remind ourselves, myself included, regularly, that the child and youth care practitioners who are currently participating in activities that I would describe as absurd were trained by us. So, colleagues, we're responsible. And I think there is a problem in the way post-secondary or in the way education or training or learning unfolds in the field of child and youth care. And the problem simply is that hierarchical institutions that are based on courses, on grades, on assessments, on a semester-by-semester basis, are just fundamentally or stand in fundamental contradiction or tension to the concept of learning in a child and youth care context. You know, I can say that some of the students who I've had the best experiences with were a disaster in their first year, potentially a disaster in their second year, but eventually came around. But the only reason they could come around is because somebody decided on the faculty side to not follow the rules and to allow that person to stick around long enough. If we actually followed the rules, we would start with a cohort of whatever, 100, and in second year we'd have 5, and in third year it'd be 1. So we got a real problem in the way we've organized the concept of learning, but through institutional lenses and institutional processes that are really quite contradictory to what learning means from a child, you know, relational learning in particular. And then, of course, there is this thing where we say to young people, you know, we have no trouble saying to young people, you got to be unbelievably courageous and face a life with likely very little support, with likely very little support, while we ourselves are shrinking away from confronting those who might have perspectives that we see as particularly destructive to young people. You know, that contradiction has to just end. If you're going to ask it of a young person, then we got to ask it of ourselves too. You know, there is a bit of a wimpishness associated with us when we don't do that. I'm getting to the end. I see there's... So, another big issue, and I'm really getting tired of this particular theme. We do, at some point, have to ask ourselves, you know, are we relevant? And if so, to who? And, you know, here come the classic words, you know, race, gender, disability, language. But I put those words up there because they always come up on slide 22. I put them up on slide 22. And maybe that's a mistake. At some point, we probably have to put them up on slide 1. But just to really hit home that message, let's talk about race. I know, a very uncomfortable topic sometimes, but let's talk about race and racism. Let me assure you that there are many, many young people who would describe their experience in our care as profoundly racist, as profoundly heteronormative, as profoundly based on a perception of ableism that has nothing to do with their lives, and as profoundly linguistically totally irrelevant to who they are. Many, many young people would say this. Of course, many child and youth care practitioners would say this too. This is not unusual. And yet we just mention it, and then we don't do anything about it. And the way, you know, the way I measure whether we've done something about it is by looking at the audience when I speak at a child and youth care conference. Let's talk about race, and let's take a good look at ourselves. No, really, take a good look at yourselves. This is a problem. You know, this is just a problem from so many different perspectives. But it is certainly a problem because it means that the overwhelming majority of humanity and life that comes with humanity and values that come with humanity and ways of being in the world that come with humanity are not finding us sufficiently relevant to be here. Don't you think it's a little problematic, like year after year after year after year? And it doesn't matter whether it's a national conference, a provincial conference, whether it's the membership of professional associations, whether it's the faculty groups in post-secondary institutions. The problem is deeply embedded. It is everywhere. We're stuck. We're going to have to do something. Right? So really, really, really important that we begin to engage these issues. So, Haley really wants to know, do young people matter? She really wants to know. And I have to tell you, and I'll end on this, I have to tell you that after what I think has been many years of being engaged in the field, of talking about child and youth care, thinking about it, writing about it, of talking with you, of talking with people like you, all over the place. The best answer I can give today to Haley, where is she? Oh, there she is. The best answer I can give today to Haley is that I hope so. That's all I got. Thanks.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.